Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to Bigwigs and Benefactors of the Pikes Peak Region. I'm Tim Blevins, and I'm with the Special Collections Division of Pikes Peak Library District. And we're really thrilled to be able to host this 11th annual Pikes Peak Regional History Symposium. Now, were some of you expecting the symposium on massacres of the Mountain West? I see a few of you. I'm so sorry. That train left last year. And it's particularly embarrassing because I see one of our today's speakers actually raise his hand. You see what happened. In putting together all the promotion for this, I accidentally, for our online promotion, pointed one of the links to last year's schedule. And yeah, it's pretty devastating. Now, I have been accused of making these errors just to get a few laughs. So, I assure you that every mistake I make is 100% genuine. Mostly. If you've not already turned off your cell phone, please do that now. Also, you can see we have some cameras here. We are actually broadcasting this event live on PPLD TV, cable channels Comcast 17 and Falcon Broadband 75. And we're also streaming this live on Ustream. And we're very grateful to Jamie Hastings and the video crew who enable us to present this to an audience who aren't able to come and be here today. Chris Nickel has assembled another fabulous day of speakers. We expect you to learn a tremendous amount about our region's history, just not about massacres. Today we'll get started with my pleasure introducing our Executive Director of Pikes Peak Library District, Paula Miller.
Always have to adjust it down, every time. So good morning, everyone. It's my pleasure to welcome you to the History Symposium today and to our bigwigs and benefactors of the Pikes Peak region. As I looked out from my house this morning and having coffee, I was going to start, as always, it's a beautiful day. Then the sun departed and some clouds started rolling in, but here's what I'm going to say. As always, it's a beautiful day in the Pikes Peak region. We appreciate your time with us this morning and attending the History Symposium. This is always, always one of our most popular annual and signature events. And we appreciate that you take the time out because it is important for us to look at our history, to examine our heritage, and that helps us understand what is happening today and what we can plan for in the future. So during the past decade here, the Pikes Peak Regional History Symposium events, and that includes the television and the internet broadcasts, the DVDs and the downloadable audios that we have done, the exhibits and the 13 regional history series of books, have reached thousands of individuals. And not just in our region, by the way, individuals beyond the region are interested in that research and that history. And those have energized a strong community interest in our region's history. The symposium has engaged our community by presenting topics that elicit discussion and debate, and it's encouraged us to learn more about our region's history and inspired us to read and seek out more information about this fascinating community. It is my pleasure to be able to give you a special announcement this morning. This year, the American Association of State and Local History, that's the American Association of State and Local History, is honoring these past 10 years of accomplishments at PPLD with the Leadership in History Award of Merit. According to this program and entity, and I quote, "By publicly recognizing superior and innovative achievements, the Leadership in History Awards serve as an inspiration to others in the field." Our thanks go to, and I don't know if Judy is here, Judy Casey, in the back, and Dr. Tom Noel, who wrote letters supporting the nomination for this symposium and its products for this most prestigious recognition of achievement in state and local history. Now, as many, how many return attendees do we have? You've been here, See, once you come and experience this, you've got to come again. And I love that it's a different focused topic every year. So you learn about different aspects of the region. Any project as big as this, however, involves many individuals, and over the years, we mean many individuals and partnerships, community agencies. So we are grateful for the excellent presenters that we've had and our steadfast sponsors over the years, as well as the many community partners who participate each year. This year's symposium, by the way, is a collaborative effort of PPLD's Special Collections and the Colorado Springs Pioneers Museum. It's made possible with funding from the Helen and James McCaffrey Fund for Regional History, the Friends of the Pikes Peak Library District, and the Pikes Peak Library District Foundation. Partners, community partners in this year's symposium include the Historic Preservation Alliance, Pikes Peak Community College, Pikes Peak Genealogical Society, Pikes Peak Posse of the Westerners, and the Western Museum of Mining and Industry, and we are also always pleased again to receive the endorsement of Colorado Humanities. Could we have a round of applause for all of those groups? I am also so honored to work with such phenomenal staff here at the Pikes Peak Library District. Special Collections staff plan these events with the assistance of the staff in the Community Engagement and Outreach Office, Facilities Department, Security Department, IT and Virtual Services, Finance, and the Foundation offices. They are all absolutely excellent, superbly dedicated staff to you. Special Collections, Chris Nichols, and Chris, if you could wave in the back, please. is the principal organizer for the Pikes Peak Regional History Symposia. So I would like to, again, huge round of applause, and you know what? Standing O would be awesome. To congratulate Chris, Tim, and everyone involved in these efforts in the past decade with just a huge celebratory round of applause. Thank you so much. And Tim, I'm going to add something that happened just 2 days ago as well. The honors are continuing. This is late breaking news. Okay. We just received notification this week that Pikes Peak Library District Special Collections Department will be receiving from Urban Libraries Council, which is the group of the largest libraries in the country, a 2014 Top Innovators Honorable Mention Award for the Waldo Canyon Fire Digital Collection. So, and in their announcement to us of this, they said, it will be seen as a model for responding in the moment and creating historical records of a life-altering event. Very much true. If you haven't had a chance to see any of that work and any of those items, please do. Please do. It's very emotional. So, and congratulations to Dennis Daly. Dennis is somewhere over there, yes, for organizing all of that.
I'm going to ask you to stand there for a minute. Hopefully this won't humiliate you. I'm going to read most of this just so I don't miss anything. Many of you may not be aware that Paula will be departing Pikes Peak Library District in a few months to lead the Baltimore County Public Library System in Maryland. Yeah, that's what I said.
Me too.
During that time, or during the time that Paula has been the executive director of PPLD, she has been wholly supportive of special collections efforts and has meaningfully contributed to the successes that we've enjoyed during her 8 years of leadership. From the get-go, Paula understood the importance of special collections, reference services and collections, understood the value of our community programs and events, and she encouraged us to strive for lofty goals. Before Paula arrived, we were reluctant to commit the word annual to our regional history symposium. She was responsible for giving us the courage to publicly pledge that the history symposium would continue each year. Paula is a planner. She cheered us on when we planned future symposium topics, now penciled in through the year 2021. And Special Collections, Pikes Peak Library District, and the entire El Paso County community are the beneficiaries of Paula's dedicated leadership and commitment to excellence and innovation. She has certainly been our bigwig, and we will miss her.
Thank you. I still can't talk with that. What an honor. What an honor it has been. It's very difficult to leave the region. This is a beautiful region and a wonderfully supportive community. And that is my message to you. Thank you to all of you for understanding the role and significance and the tradition of public library service to any community. You have done that beautifully. This symposium is a great example of that. So there is nothing more important than that community support and knowing that you value knowledge, you value the tradition of public library service and what it brings to our community. So thank you to all of you. It truly has been an honor to serve.
I asked Paula to go down the stairs. I've fallen off of this stage before. That was during the disaster symposium.
At least it wasn't a massacre.
It wasn't a massacre. Thank you. That was good. It's now my privilege to introduce our first speaker and subsequent MC, Michael L. Olson. Mike is a professor emeritus at New Mexico Highlands University, where he taught a variety of American history courses from 1973 through 2002. From 2003 to 2007, he taught full-time at Pikes Peak Community College here in Colorado Springs. He holds a BA from St. Olaf College and the MA and PhD from the University of Washington. Dr. Olson has had a connection with the Santa Fe Trail and Santa Fe Trail Association. He published extensively on trail history, particularly regarding social aspects of the multicultural issues. Dr. Olson has often participated in the production of the Regional History Series and the symposium, and he's a researcher, presenter, and moderator in all of those events and books, and he's also a guest editor. Please join me in welcoming Mike Olson.
You know, over the years, Tim keeps honing his stand-up comedian skills. I don't know. It's getting to be a tough act to follow here. So, okay. My purpose here this morning is to sort of set the theme for the day, set the theme for the symposium, bigwigs and benefactors of the Pikes Peak region. To do that, I'm sort of going to play devil's advocate, as is indicated by the title of my presentation, Pennies from Heaven, question mark, okay? I think we're all familiar with the old song, Pennies from Heaven, Every Time It Rains, Pennies. I thought of having a sing-along, but I wasn't going to push it, okay? You know, every time it rains pennies from heaven. Every cloud, Paula, see, those clouds came in today just for me. They'll be dropping pennies from heaven. Don't get a frown on your face. Turn your umbrella upside down, and pennies from heaven will fall into it. But as I say, I sort of want to play devil's advocate in that, well, where do those pennies come from? At risk of making you groan, every penny has two sides, okay? And not only the pennies themselves, where were those pennies earned? How did the person, the benefactor, the benefactress, the bigwig, get those pennies? But as we're going to see in a number of the presentations today, it isn't just giving money, but pennies from heaven can involve personal sacrifice. It can involve standing up for injustices. And so there's always, it's not a negative side. I don't want to be negative, but it's another side that we should keep in mind as we're considering the lives and careers and services of the people that we're going to meet along the way today. To begin with, I was once told by my speech instructor in college, never start with an apology. I'm going to start with an apology. An apology to Paula, to Tim, to everybody at the public Pikes Peak Library District. Fabulous as this facility is, fabulous as the library district is, fabulous as the new facility is going to be out there in Briargate, this is my favorite library, okay? This is the library, as it says, the Carnegie Library in Las Vegas, New Mexico. Obviously, is a Carnegie Library. It was built in 1904, and it's modeled after Monticello. It's sort of a mini Monticello, okay? It is only one of four unaltered Carnegie libraries left in the United States. Nothing has changed in this library. Not a wall has been moved. I was thinking about how to emphasize this, and I guess I'll sort of drift off this way. Even the public restrooms, at least the men's room, has not changed since 1904, okay? So it's a Carnegie library. It's brought to us, of course, by this man, Andrew Carnegie. Andrew Carnegie sold his steel empire in 1901 to J.P. Morgan for $900 million, and he devoted himself to being a benefactor. The Carnegie Endowment eventually funded 2,509 public libraries in the United States. On the other hand, Andrew Carnegie brought us the Homestead Steel Strike in 1892. Now, with Carnegie, we're not going to debate what his role was and that sort of thing. He owned the steel mill. And as one source says, this Homestead Steel Strike was an industrial lockout and strike which began on June 30th, 1892, culminating in a battle between strikers and private security agents on July 6th, 1892. The battle was one of the most serious disputes in U.S. labor history. Pennies from heaven, okay? We can also take a look at this. Beautiful, okay? This is Great Smoky Mountains National Park. There was a picture from Great Smoky Mountains National Park in the Gazette this morning about fireflies or something like that. It's the most visited national park in the United States. Much of it was assembled from private land, which was purchased with money from this benefactor, John D. Rockefeller. Not arguably, he was America's first billionaire. He had a fortune of $2 billion when he died. But of course, we all know in this room and in Colorado Springs and in Colorado that in a way, John D. Rockefeller brought us the Ludlow Massacre. I'm not going there, okay? We're not going to debate Rockefeller's role. But to follow up on that, if you haven't visited the Ludlow exhibit at the Pioneers Museum, sponsor of this symposium, do so. There's a great deal of depth there, gives you a lot of time for thought about this penny from heaven, okay? A national park versus the Ludlow Massacre. Now, switching gears, we're going to talk about some of the terms we'll be using today, okay? First of all, bigwig. Tim sort of blew my line here because he called Paula, our bigwig. And actually, Tim, bigwig is kind of a negative term. I didn't find any bigwig that I really wanted to associate with, okay? But bigwig, it comes from, it's defined in the Oxford English Dictionary as a man, and we'll be talking about that in a moment, of high official standing or of note or importance, and then the OED puts in humorous or contemptuous, okay? I think Marge is humorous and Lord Birkenhead is contemptuous, okay? I always am interested in the history of words. And the history of the word bigwig goes back to 1781 with George Selwyn, who was a member of Parliament. He was in Parliament for 44 years and never said a word. He's my kind of politician, okay? But he served on a lot of commissions, and in one commission, he said, a new point of discussion for the lawyers, for our bigwigs, for the lordships, etc. Okay? George Eliot used it in Middlemarch, as you can read, and Auden used it in his famous poem from the 1930s, The Age of Anxiety. More along our line is, what is a benefactor or a benefactress? Again, the OED says a benefactor is one who renders aid or kindly services to others. And that's important for our symposium today. It's not just money. Benefactor, you can benefit people. By the way, benefactor, beneficial, facet in Latin, to make, to do, bene, good. So some way of doing good, not just through money. Or one who makes a benefaction to a charitable or religious institution, one who makes a bequest or endowment. And there you can see the various uses going all the way back to 1594. My favorite one there, is Francis Bacon. We call them dowrymen or benefactors. Now, you also in the OED, you can get benefactress. It's in the dictionary. And I love the definition. The definition of benefactress is a female benefactor, okay? When will we get to the day? He steps away from the podium. When will we get to the day when a benefactor is called a male benefactress? I have my doubts, okay? This is used in 1711 by Jonathan Swift, 1781 by Edward Gibbon. I got all involved with the Edward Gibbon one. I went and looked up where he said it, and I got to reading about the Empress Irene, and it was nasty. So you get led off track. And then we have some more pictures here. It was kind of interesting. I always read the Today in History column in the Gazette, and this morning in 1654, His Honor over there with the big wig, Louis XIV, was crowned King of France. So I thought that was kind of appropriate. Well, we're going to hear about a number of benefactors, benefactresses, and big wig. By the way, there isn't a big wigus in the OED, okay? And I've thrown in a quote here from Marshall Sprague's Newport in the Rockies. I just want to read the paragraph that precedes this from his book, because it sort of ties everything together for us. He's talking about why did Spencer Penrose, in particular, establish the El Palmar, you know what I'm saying, Foundation, okay? He says, this sort of private tax-free foundation had been around for a long time, evolving from the Carnegie Institution, 1902, and the Rockefeller Foundation, 1913. While Spencer Penrose, studied the possibilities of its operation, two of his business associates were studying also. One was the New York banker Charles Hayden, who would create the great Hayden Foundation for helping needy young men. The other was Charles Betcher, the Denver financier who would set up the general purpose Betcher Foundation. So what we're getting, when you're listening to folks today talking about our bigwigs and benefactors, much of it comes from the mining background and the money that was made in mining and in sugar beets and that sort of thing. But it's about 50 years later than the national ones, okay? But it is part of that. There's a connection there, okay? I want to mention some people that I would like to have seen some papers on, starting with the ladies. Alice Bemis Taylor, perhaps my favorite benefactress in Colorado Springs. She was a benefactress of Colorado College, the Colorado Springs Arts Center. There's a beautiful portrait of her there at the Arts Center. I always tip my hat to Alice, and then I go see the fabulous Native American collection of artifacts that she assembled. She funded the Colorado Springs Day Nursery with its fabulous Tudor building down there on East Rio Grande. She was instrumental in funding Glockner Hospital, which is now Penrose Hospital. She provided some funding for Rock Ledge Historic Ranch site. It was said of her philanthropy, there must be three things which helped to shape the major philanthropies of Alice Bemis Taylor's life. An inner compulsion to share what she had, the Bemis building bug, as Mrs. Taylor herself described it, with its fascination for architecture, and a fervent desire to bring beauty to the lives who had little or none. Then we're going to hear from Julie Penrose today. She's going to visit us this afternoon. But in particular, she donated or established the Broadmoor Art Academy. She was instrumental in setting up again and leading the Elpore Moir Foundation. She led the capital campaign and significantly funded the Glockner Penrose Hospital. And I've included V. Bradenburg here, A, because I belong to the Colorado Springs Philharmonic, and the B. Bradenburg Foundation sponsors some of those concerts, okay? But I also included, her name is, well, you hear it on the radio and that sort of thing. But she represents, again, that aspect of benefaction that is, we don't just think of Rockefeller and Carnegie. The B. Bradenburg Foundation is particularly involved with the arts. And when I went on their website, they had their financial statement there. And in 2010, they donated $158,261 to various efforts in the Colorado Springs region. It's not Carnegie. It's not Rockefeller. Warren Buffett, he's not here, okay? But this is important, too. Now, I've also included some of the gentlemen. We've got Charles Leeming Tutt. I put him in. Nobody's talking on him. And alas, as I say, there's no statue of him. He's the scion, the founder of the Tutt dynasty, came as an associate of Spencer Penrose, died young, died in 1909 at the age of 45. There's going to be an exhibition. There are cards out there on the table, at the Pioneers Museum coming up on June 28th, the Midas Touch, Spencer Penrose and Charles Tutt Partnership. So check in on that. The other guys, you can visit them, okay? I did want to say a few words about Stratton, Winfield Scott Stratton, because again, no one is particularly speaking on him. He sold his mining interests in 1900 for $10 million, and of course established the Myron Stratton home, which he named after his father. But of course, that $10 million as pennies from heaven, those pennies had a long journey to get to the Myron Stratton home. The bequest of $10 million to the Myron Stratton home was not popular with many. After extended litigation, from many, including his son, and 13 women who claimed to have been secretly married to Stratton, only $6 million was finally available, but the home was established successfully in 1913. And I've included General Palmer. You've got to include General Palmer. But there are other General Palmer monuments than the horse, okay? So look around town and tip your hat to General Palmer. And finally, just because I wanted to, I've included Eugene Percy Shove, who funded the endowment for that fabulous chapel at Colorado College. And once again, he made his money in mining and in sugar beets. He was president of Holly Sugar Company. But he's not one of the great wealthy benefactors. But he wanted to honor his clerical ancestors, and he felt that there should be a chapel on the Colorado College campus. He's another one of those examples. We've got a range of benefactors here, not just rich people. Okay? And then finally, to come full circle and to emphasize the question mark at the end of my presentation, we've got Thomas Jefferson again in Monticello. Dabney Carr Jr. was Jefferson's nephew, and he gave a eulogy for Jefferson and said, "The loss of Mr. Jefferson is one over which the whole world will mourn. He was one of those ornaments and benefactors of the human race whose death forms an epoch." But then in a local newspaper, we get the ad, "Will be sold for his estate on the 15th of January at Monticello in the county of Albemarle. The whole of the residue of the personal estate of Thomas Jefferson, deceased, consisting of 130 valuable Negroes." Pennies from heaven, anybody? Okay, so think of that as we go through the day. Thank you. And now a 2-second break. As Tim said, I'm Mike Olson, and I'm your moderator today. And it's going to be my pleasure to introduce our speakers, say a little bit about them, and that sort of thing. Three housekeeping issues as we get started. As I say, I'll be introducing them. I may say things, you'll sit there and think, "I already know that. Why is he talking about that?" We've got a TV audience out there. We've got a web audience out there. As I mentioned last year, my brother always watches from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, on his, but he's on the road today, so it's his problem. So I will be saying things so that those people who are not here in this energized room will know more or less what's going on. We do have a timekeeper, Doris McGraw. Stand up, Doris. When you see Doris stand up, you don't need to be concerned, but you folks down here, it's time to say, "And in conclusion," okay. So thank you, Doris, for doing that. And Dennis has been introduced, but Dennis is our guru, okay? Every speaker who comes up here, we may look polished, okay? We may look confident, we're not. And if any flubs occur, Dennis is imperturbable. He'll take care of them. We got Dennis sitting over there, okay? And then finally, at the end of every session, we will be taking questions. We'll have 8-10 minutes for questions. I'll ask the speakers from that session to come up, and you can direct a very short question to them, okay? Keep your questions short. Have I made my point? They should be short. They should be short for two reasons. One, I'm getting old, okay? And if you ask a long question, I can't repeat it, which is what I do, because we've tried the roaming microphone and we've tried that let's walk up and talk in the microphone. It doesn't work. I'll repeat the question so everybody here can hear it, and then our audience at home will also know it. So it has to be kept short for that reason. It also has to be kept short because if you've got a philosophy of life, we really don't want to hear it, okay? So keep it to the point. So with that, it's my pleasure to introduce David Finley as our first speaker. I know David through the Pikes Peak Posse of the Westerners, a sponsor. There are membership things out on the table out there, okay? David earned his undergraduate degree from West Point, and following his military service, he earned an MA and PhD in political science from Stanford University. He's a longtime Colorado Springs resident and retired faculty member from Colorado College, where he taught mostly international and comparative politics, including his specialty, Cold War Soviet-American relations, and where he served for 5 years as dean of the college and faculty. He retired in 2000, and with his wife, Judy Reed Finley, who's been a speaker in this series, continues to live happily in the historic Old North End of Colorado Springs. David.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you all for your interest here. I'm encouraged that most of the benefactors we saw Mike present up here, they need wigs as much as I do. But I knew a little bit about an old Dutchman, Edmund van Diest, who had been associated with General Palmer, And when my wife, Judy, who worked in special collections at Tutt Library, told me that the Van Deest papers occupy more space than just about any other manuscript collection there, why, we both decided it would be worthwhile to find out more about him. And as we did, it began to look as though this Dutchman had been significantly connected to the turn of the century development in southern Colorado, and also with General Palmer, to the development of the Colorado Springs area. And lastly, he'd had an important role in the life of Colorado College. And we both have worked on this story a bit, and that's what I'm going to impose on you for a little while today. Edmund Cornelius Van Deest was a Dutchman. He was born on the island of Java in the Dutch East Indies in August of 1865. And his father, Peter Van Deest, had been sent out there by the Dutch government as a mining engineer and later as Governor General of Java. And after illness required returning with his family to Holland, Peter joined the Dutch Caribou Company, which owned some mines in Colorado as well as elsewhere. And so the family moved again. And about 1879, Peter was appointed to the U.S. Surveyor General's office in Denver. He also taught as a professor of metallurgy at the newly established School of Mines in Golden. And thus his own young son, Edmund Van Deest, attended East High School in Denver and became one of the first graduates in mine engineering at the School of Mines in 1886. Now, given the high profile of mining in the new state and the frontier opportunities on the former Mexican land grants down on the New Mexico border, it was not surprising that the new graduate began his own career running some land surveys in the San Luis Valley. Now, the big Sangre de Cristo grant comprised about 1 million acres on the southwest side of the Sangres, divided since the 1860s between the Trinchera estate there on the north and the Costilla estate to the south. And Edmund's survey work led quickly to his becoming the engineer and manager of what was called the United States Freehold Land and Emigration Company. That was the legal entity that then owned the Costilla estate. And while thus employed, Edmund met and married Anna Louise Meyer, the daughter of Ferdinand Meyer, a prominent citizen of Taos County, and this happened at Costilla in 1890. And Edmund Van Deest and Louise built a home at Costilla where they lived for the next 12 years, called Meadow Farm. And from 1893 until 1891, Edmund's engineering affiliation expanded to include manager and mineral engineer of the Trinchera estate to the north, as well as the Costilla. And from 1888 on, he was president of the Rito Seco Mining Company there on Trinchera. And from 1900 through 1906, he also served as the president and the construction engineer for the Eureka Exploration Company out as far as Silverton. He would focus his whole career on Colorado economic development and especially on mining and civil engineering. But the DNRG and the Rio Grande Western Railroads, and more particularly their founder, William Jackson Palmer, opened new horizons too. The DNRG had made it to Placer, a mining settlement on the Trinchera estate, by the end of 1877. And the next year, it was completed on to Alamosa, and soon it became a supply line for mining exploration in the southwest corner of Colorado. And along with the railroad came its visionary owner, General Palmer, and a new impetus for settlements and economic development. But it would still be another 10 years before Edmund Van Diest actually connected with Palmer himself, and that's when those new horizons opened up for him. And that happened in 1903 at a campsite on Costilla Creek, just south of the New Mexico line. Palmer, Van Diest recollected much later, told stories around the campfire of his trials and experiences with the Rio Grande Western, and he expressed his interest to learn more about the Tierra Amarilla grant further to the south. And a four-day horseback trip around ensued, during which Palmer and Van Diest got to know one another well and to gain mutual respect. Palmer had sold his Rio Grande Western in 1901, and he was ready to turn to new projects and his philanthropic interests. 8 years after the death of his wife, Queen, Palmer conceived a total reconstruction of his Glen Eyrie castle in Colorado Springs. He needed a new assistant now for the new prospects, and in Edmund Van Diest, he spotted just the energetic, bright, and ambitious young alter ego that he wanted. So in short order, he drew Van Diest into his employment, and for the next 6 years that remained before Palmer's premature death in 1909, well, they complemented one another as a dynamic team. So it was late in 1903 when Van Diest and his family came over the mountains to Colorado Springs, took up residence at 719 North Nevada Avenue. And Van Diest found an office in the Out West building and became Palmer's agent. Now, General Palmer's Glen Eyrie Castle was reconstructed over the years 1904 through 1906, with Edmund Van Diest in charge. And for much of that time, Palmer himself was absent from Colorado Springs, mainly in Europe. And these old photos show something of the scale of the project. Here's the original Glen Eyrie from the 1870s. Here's the construction foundation for the renovation that Van Diest supervised. And when Palmer returned in August of 1906, the transformation that he envisioned had been realized, and quite a difference from the original Glen Eyrie. Now, officially, Van Diest became Palmer's construction engineer for Glen Eyrie. But Van Diest's correspondence copybooks show a dizzying array of other subjects, too. No item seems to have been too big or small to have received his careful attention, including such Palmer interests as a Cascade Avenue median, as a roof reinforcement for Palmer's Antlers Hotel, and even I found pine bark beetle infestations throughout Colorado. Yes, 100 years ago. One copybook for a six-month period in 1905 contains over 500 separate letters and memoranda, and the range and authority of Van Diest's decisions display a growing trust in his relationship with Palmer, which really became more that of partners than of employer and employee. And aside from Glen Eyrie, Van Diest's most memorable and enduring project with Palmer was Monument Valley Park. As Colorado Springs had grown up over the years since 1871, the two-mile strip of grassland on Monument Creek remained a disregarded waste area, but it was very visible to all visitors coming south from Denver on the train. Thus, it seemed to Palmer an ideal location for a park And Palmer secured the land by late 1903, and then it became Van Deest's job to make the park. Now, from 1904 to 1907, Van Deest regularly employed over 100 workmen at a time on various related construction jobs for the 165-acre Monument Valley Park. These included extensive grading, bridge building, irrigation facilities, creek stabilization, vast plantings of trees and shrubs and flowers. A very notable project was the fine geologic column on the lower right here, which had been proposed by Van Deest and approved from afar by Palmer, and which most of us are very familiar with, and which I believe Steve Ruskin detailed in a presentation to this symposium a couple of years ago. Now, aside from Monument Valley Park, Palmer donated Palmer Park, the Cutler Mountain Trail, and the High Drive. He provided funds for the maintenance of other parks and trails, all to be administered by a new city park commission established in 1908 with Edmund Van Deest, the influential secretary of that commission. Now, after Palmer's death in March of 1909, Van Deest shepherded Palmer's vision of the park system in an official role as a city engineering consultant. And he continued his active engagement at the same time with Colorado Mining Development and also undertook engineering design projects for public and private utilities in Colorado and beyond. Reservoirs, bridges, dams, water systems, refrigeration for ice storage plants. He served as president of numerous small companies, including the Intermountain Rail Light and Power Company and a Western Public Service Company. And at home in Colorado Springs, he was consulting engineer for the Myron Stratton home, later for the Broadmoor, for Grace Church, and Colorado College. And for all these enterprises, one can see the basis in Van Deest's earlier experiences during the Costilla years, as well as his years with Palmer. And at a time in those days when the horizons for American industry seemed unlimited. Well, serious civic engagement accompanied Van Deest's business life. He was one of the founders of the Colorado-Wyoming Kiwanis, an active member of local and later national chambers of commerce. And in Colorado Springs, he served at least twice as president of the El Paso Club, and he became a director of the First National Bank. And he also focused on community and state child welfare programs. One important example of his civic engagement was his central role in memorializing General Palmer. Just a few months after Palmer's death, Van Deest became the faithful secretary of this group incorporated as the William J. Palmer Memorial Association, which began soliciting contributions for an equestrian statue. But the project lagged as World War I intervened, and it was in the mid-20s before serious momentum for that project was regained and for trying to get funding and for choosing a sculptor. Then an urgent campaign propelled by Edmund Van Deest included community-wide solicitation by local ministers from their pulpits to get proposed statues for Palmer. This one that looks more like the end of the trail was not chosen. Well, meanwhile, actually the funding was completed with Van Deest's active proponency, and on September, there, for a while we had a base there, but we wondered where the horse was coming from. Finally, on the 1st of September in 1929, Edmund Van Diest was able to make this presentation to the city of Colorado Springs to Mayor Birdsall on behalf of the Palmer Memorial Association. Meanwhile, during the 1920s, Van Diest's association with Colorado College evolved. It evolved, as so much of his career did, from his work with General Palmer. It had started back in 1904, when Palmer directed Van Diest to enlarge the existing Washburn Field to the west, to use a portion of the area that was planned for Monument Valley Park. And there's a view of it back in the earlier days. Van Diest's continuing interest in education and in college athletics led him to head up a successful academic endowment campaign for the college in the mid-1920s. As reported here by the Gazette in December of 1925, this was quite successful. And Van Diest at the same time promoted and personally financed and built a spectator-oriented football stadium for Washburn Field. This is a football game in 1927 there, well attended. And these projects really accompanied Van Diest's election to the Board of Trustees in 1925, which was an appointment that would last for the rest of his life. Van Diest also served as a trustee member of this Colorado College Athletics Board after 1927. And the Van Diest Gold Medal, inaugurated in 1926, continues to this day to be awarded each spring to the senior man who has most distinguished himself in sports, scholarship, and a high level of citizenship over 4 years' attendance at the college. Well, Van Diest's political affinity throughout his adult life was staunchly Republican. He strongly believed in free enterprise as the hallmark of individual liberty and the foundation for social progress. He became increasingly critical in the 1930s of what he perceived to be excessive experimentation in Roosevelt's New Deal. For example, he had no love for the Social Security program. In spite of that, he was invited to join the Business Advisory Council of FDR's first Secretary of Commerce, and he apparently became a respected voice on the cautionary side of drastic federal agency regulatory authority. Now, this is his grandson, David Van Diest Skilling, currently a member of the College Board of Trustees. And Van recalled to me his own admiration for Edmund Van Diest. Grandfather was Zaza, a tall, sturdy gentleman with a big gray mustache who enjoyed his cigars and playing cards and never entirely lost his Dutch accent. He treasured a handsome family chair which had been awarded to his father Peter by the Dutch monarch for his service in the Indies. And grandmother and grandfather Van Diest lived in a gracious home at 1730 North Cascade that grandfather had built in 1927. And his garage shop had all sorts of fascinating sights for the young grandson who came to visit. And it included a lightning arrestor experiment that Van remembers gave out vivid sparks and led to an application later to Will Rogers Shrine and Grace Church. Sometimes there were big family dinners, and I'm running out of time here, and I will stop exceedingly soon. But I want to tell you one little story that Van allows me to pass along. He says at one dinner, formal dinner at this house, why parental conversation wandered into politics, and FDR's name was spoken. And his scowling grandfather raised his eyes and sternly pronounced, "That son of a bitch." And thereupon, grandfather pushed back his chair and arose and bowed and turned and silently walked out of the dining room, and Van says he worshiped him. Now, gradually, Bendy's health declined. He died at home in August 1, 1950, after a full life spanning 85 years. I believe he manifested some of the strongest virtues of a post-pioneer generation of uniquely American builders and leaders who shaped the state, the nation, Colorado Springs, and Colorado College, too. He served Palmer well. Palmer influenced him profoundly. And I see the ghost of Palmer in his style and achievements, and I'm happy to call him Palmer's extraordinary engineer and a real bigwig and benefactor of the Pikes Peak region. Thank you.